As we've seen, Greek literature got a jump start on Latin literature by about 500 years. Homer and Hesiod were both composing their epics around 700 BC. By contrast, the first surviving works in Latin, the comedies of Plautus, aren't much earlier than 200 BC. And although Livius Andronicus and others were writing in Latin half a century earlier, no work in Latin has survived from that period. Very likely, later Romans came to regard their earliest efforts at writing to be extremely crude and therefore not worth preserving. 200 BC then is effectively the birth date of Latin literature. Yet, when we turn to Greek literature around the same period, we discover that it was in decline and had been for some time. That's not to say that there weren't still a number of important Greek writers working in a variety of genres. Now, the Hellenistic poets in particular were extremely prolific and inventive. And it's also a fact that Greek literature would undergo a revival in the reign of the Emperor Nero, 54 to 68, which would continue into the 3rd century AD. Even so, it wasn't of the same world-class stature as its classical forebear. So, you get this disjunction. Greek literature was in decline by the end of the 4th century BC, whereas Latin literature didn't peak until the end of the 1st century BC. I'm going to be talking about four genres in this lecture, in the order in which they achieved their heyday in Roman society: love poetry, satire, history, and novels. Love was one of the first subjects to engage the Greek poets after epic had gone into decline in the 7th century BC. But unlike epic, which was invariably written in hexameters, love poetry employed a variety of meters. The choice depended on the character and mood of the poem. Pretty much all love poetry, Greek as well as Roman, is about feelings. There's rarely any description of the physical act of lovemaking, and nor do we ever learn much even about the physical charms of the beloved. Often, the poet, or rather the persona that the poet adopts, not necessarily the same thing by any means, expresses a range of negative feelings. He's miserable because he's separated from his beloved, jealous because she loves someone else, or angry because he's been rejected. Rarely do we get a sense of two hearts beating as one. It's rather surprising that this kind of poetry caught on at all among the Romans, though we should acknowledge that interest in it was always confined to the elite. When the Romans first encountered it, we can imagine that they were rather disdainful. Over time, however, they discovered, perhaps to their surprise, that they too had feelings. Feelings that were every bit as tender and as sensitive and as passionate as those of the Greeks. As far as the writing of poetry is concerned, this discovery took place in the first half of the 1st century BC, and it resulted in some of the finest poetry ever written. Its exponents are Catullus, Propertius, Tibullus, Virgil, and Ovid. Their working lives lasted well under a century, from the late Republic to the early Principate. We learn a great deal about the difference between the two cultures by studying love poetry. First, Roman love poetry engages the reader more in the emotional world of the beloved than its Greek equivalent does, though this may be due in part to the fact that it survives in much greater quantity. Catullus, approximate dates 84 to 54 BC, writes his most famous poems, 25 out of a total of 116, about his girlfriend, whom he dubs Lesbia. Lesbia means the girl from the island of Lesbos, and it is probably intended as a tribute to Sappho of Lesbos, the poetess who wrote very movingly about her love for young women. Catullus runs the gamut of all the emotions of the infatuated lover: tenderness, passion, disillusionment, rejection, betrayal, hatred, even contempt. No one excels him in exploring all that is most painful and humiliating about the lover's condition. His poems strike such an authentic note that it seems to some readers they must be autobiographical. Surviving Greek love poetry, though also very moving, doesn't come close to providing the reader with a sense of the ups and downs of an ongoing relationship. Though, as I said a moment ago, this may be due to the fact that only a fraction of the total oeuvre of any one poet or poetess has survived. Second, Latin love poetry is often grounded in a convincingly presented social reality. It was produced at a time when high-born women were achieving greater freedom than ever before, notably in the conduct of their sexual lives. This is reflected in their characterization as strong-willed, forceful, and even domineering, which is certainly true of Lesbia. And third, Latin love poetry was born out of the grim political realities of the late 1st century BC, when Rome was devastated by a protracted period of civil war. Though that fact doesn't emerge explicitly, the poetry seems to function as a reaction to those terrible events, as a way of constructing a personal world that has meaning and value despite the terrible things that are happening in the world outside. One of the most popular meters of Latin love poetry was the elegiac couplet, a hexameter line consisting of 6 feet, followed by a pentameter line consisting of 5 feet. Both are based on the dactyl, the foot that consists of a long syllable followed by 2 shorts. Listen to the following elegiac couplet by Catullus. Odietamo quaid faciam fortasse requires. That's the hexameter. Nescio sed fieri sentio et ex crucior. And that's the pentameter. It's a terrific couplet. It means, I hate you and I love you. You want to know why? I can't answer that, but I feel it to be so, and I'm in total agony. The elegiac couplet was invented by the Greeks, so it was not exclusive to love poetry. On the contrary, it was used for poems on a variety of subjects. In fact, the word derives from the Greek elegos, meaning a lament, perhaps to utter the sound a in lament. But it was the Romans who made it the vehicle of some of the most sublime love poetry ever written, although they also used a number of other meters. We'll turn next to the writing of history. History comes from the Greek word historia, which means inquiry. It was the Greeks who initiated the tradition of historical inquiry. History, of course, is written in prose, and it'll be useful to say a few words about the development of this medium. Greece had already produced a number of first-rate poets in a variety of genres long before any of its writers turned their hand to prose. That's because poetry stands a far better chance of survival than prose, as it can be memorized, and so its survival doesn't depend upon writing. Whereas we have poetry from the late 8th century BC, no prose work has survived before the early 5th century BC. The earliest is a history written by Herodotus, dubbed by Cicero the father of history, though others before him had blazed the trail. Herodotus's subject is the wars between the Persians and the Greeks that were fought from 499 to 479 BC. His objective, as he declares in the opening sentence of the histories, is to ensure that the memory of men's achievements should not be erased by the passage of time, and that the wonderful deeds of the Greeks and the barbarians be not without glory. However, Herodotus also charts the steps by which the Persians came to dominate Asia Minor. And in so doing, he describes the different customs of the peoples whom the Persians encountered and conquered along their way to attacking Greece. Thucydides, who was born about a generation later than Herodotus, wrote about the Peloponnesian War, 431 to 404 BC, though he died before he'd completed it. He takes a very different stance in regard to history writing from Herodotus. Early on, he warns his readers that his work will give little pleasure to those who seek only romance and sensationalism, an obvious jibe at Herodotus, who delighted in telling a good story for its own sake. Instead, he wants his work to be a possession for always, rather than something designed simply for the pleasure of the moment. A generation later, Xenophon wrote a history of Greece, Hellenica, which starts where Thucydides left off in 410 BC and continues to 362, the year of the Battle of Mantinea, which actually left Greece in a state of confusion before the rise of Philip II of Macedon. Though Roman historical writing took inspiration from Greek models, its roots also lay in a native Roman tradition. That tradition, derived from the Annales Maximi, which literally means the most important events that occurred during the year, these were kept by the priestly authorities. The Annales Maximi recorded abnormal occurrences such as eclipses, prodigies, monstrosities, and disasters. There seems to have been no Greek equivalent. They were not literature as such, nor were they history, but they provided a framework, and indeed a source book, for those who did write history, including Sallust, Livy, and Tacitus. At the beginning, we see evidence of Greek influence, however, in the fact that the first Roman historian, Quintus Fabius Pictor, late 3rd century BC, wrote his account of Rome's early history in Greek. And from this we can deduce that Pictor's readership comprised either Greeks or educated Romans who could read Greek. The first history written in Latin was the Origines of Cato the Elder, which Cato began writing in 168 BC and left uncompleted at his death. But even a generation later than Cato, Greek was still the language of historical discourse, as we see from the fact that Polybius was writing in Greek with a Roman readership in mind. In fact, he expressly states that he expects that most of his readers will be Romans, since, I quote, "the most brilliant achievements that my work describes were done by them." Let's talk next about the chief differences between the Greek and Roman historical writings. First, unlike the Greeks, whose interest extended outwards to other peoples and other lands, the Romans were preoccupied with the Roman state, both with its internal politics and with its military accomplishments. They rarely wrote about other peoples. Caesar's commentaries on the Gallic Wars, for instance, has very little to say about the customs and practices of the people he was fighting, the Gauls, the Germans, and the Britons. If he'd been more interested in them, how could he have justified killing so many of them? One exception is Tacitus's Germania, which provides a brief description of the customs and character of the Germani. Even here, however, there's a Roman agenda. Tacitus is implicitly contrasting the simplicity and hardihood of the Germans with the degeneracy and corruption of contemporary Romans. Second, as the point I just mentioned indicates, Roman historical writing contained a moral dimension that was completely alien to the very spirit of Greek historical inquiry. That's not to say that Greek historians didn't expect their readers to reflect and learn from history. In that sense, they were just as didactic as the Romans. But take the case of Thucydides. As I mentioned before, he wants his book to be a possession for always, not so that his readers will better themselves from reading it, but because, as he goes on to say, human nature being what it is, the same sort of things are going to happen again. Thucydides, in other words, is talking universally. That's very different, I think, from, say, the Roman historian Sallust, writing in the last generation of the Republic, who was preoccupied with the collapse of moral values that he saw around him. Or from Livy, writing in the age of Augustus, who detected a moral decline in Roman values consequent upon the civil wars, which Augustus was incapable, in his view, of arresting. Or from Tacitus, writing around the beginning of the 2nd century AD, filled with cynicism for the epoch which he writes about, from the accession of Tiberius to the death of Domitian. The third important difference is that Greek historians tended to be outsiders. Herodotus was an inveterate traveller. Thucydides turned to writing only after he had been exiled from Athens, charged with military incompetence. And Xenophon was a mercenary in the pay of a Persian prince. Roman historians, by contrast, including Sallust, Tacitus, Dio Cassius, were almost all senators, men who served Rome and whose perspective on the world was decidedly pro-establishment and patrician. Livy, who held no official position, is an exception, but he too came from a wealthy background and was on close terms with Augustus. I now want to turn to the interesting subject of Greek historians who wrote about the Romans. The first was Timaeus of Taromenium, approximately 350 to 260 BC, who, though his chief subject was Sicily, gave a full, albeit outline, account of Rome's history down to 264. The next of note was Polybius, whom I've talked about already, both as a source for the period from 264 to 146 BC, and as a friend of Scipio Aemilianus. Polybius, as I mentioned earlier, claimed to be writing primarily for Romans, but it's clear that one of his central goals was to explain Rome to the Greeks. And we see this from the non-narrative digressions. The most important comes in Book 6, where he analyzes the structure of the Roman constitution, which he extols as an admirable synthesis of democratic, oligarchic, and monarchical elements. Polybius is fascinated by Rome's rise to power, but he's also alert to the fact that standards of morality are declining in consequence, though that hardly makes him a moralist. One of my favourite passages comes towards the end of his work, and it's central to the topic of this course being a blend of Greek and Roman elements. Polybius is describing the destruction of Carthage in 146, which his dear, dear friend Scipio Aemilianus has just caused. He writes, Scipio, when he gazed upon the city as it was falling into ruin and being destroyed, is said to have wept openly for his enemies. Scipio then quoted a line from the Iliad. The day will come when sacred Ilion shall perish, and Priam, and all his people. And when Polybius asked him what he meant, Scipio said he feared for his own country when he reflected on the fate of all human endeavour. How very Greek, that strain of pessimism, and the mutability of fortune, a favourite theme. But in the current context, it's also very Roman. The weariness at running the world. It's a theme that will later be picked up by Virgil. Moving on, in the reign of Augustus, Dionysius of Halicarnassus wrote a highly complementary history of Rome down to the outbreak of the First Punic War, in which he claimed that Rome was in fact founded by Greeks. A more important figure is Plutarch, though he was a biographer rather than a historian. Plutarch was born at Chaeronea in central Greece in the late 1st century AD. He had the brilliant idea of writing paired lives of famous Greeks and Romans, plus the lives of a few others who weren't paired. So the orators Demosthenes and Cicero get paired together, as do the generals Alexander the Great and Julius Caesar. He is, in fact, an early advocate of the notion of, an integrated history of Greece and Rome, in that he saw not only Greeks and Romans, but also Greek and Roman history itself mirroring one another in important ways. To his immense credit, Plutarch makes no attempt to assess the relative moral worth of the Greeks and Romans, and nor to identify specifically Greek or Roman character traits. As such, his work is blessedly free of any racial stereotyping. In the words of Donald Russell, he was an active exponent of the concept of a partnership between Greece, the educator, and Rome, the great power, and of the compatibility of the two loyalties. Plutarch had a tremendous influence down the ages, not least on Shakespeare, whose Antony and Cleopatra, Coriolanus, and Julius Caesar all derive from his biographies. It's been aptly said of Shakespeare that he learned more about Greek and Roman history from Sir Thomas North's translation of Plutarch, published in 1579, than most people would learn from reading the entire contents of the British Library, or the Library of Congress, for that matter. The last in this group of Greek historians writing about Rome was another great admirer of Roman virtues, Appian of Alexandria, born towards the end of the 1st century AD, whose account covered the whole sweep of Roman history down to his own day. Next, I want to turn to a literary genre where Greek influence was more limited, namely satire. Satire can be written in prose or in poetry of any metre, though hexameter became the preferred form. It includes vituperation of individuals and castigation of social and political mores, as well as more moderate forms of criticism. "Satire, at least, is wholly ours," so said Quintilian, an orator who was born in AD 35. Well, sorry to disappoint you, Marcus, old chap. The Greeks got there before you. In fact, the origins of satire go back to the 7th century BC, to Archilochus, quite possibly the father of invective. Archilochus wrote so venomously about one of his enemies, a man named Lycambes, that the latter took his own life, or so the story goes. A Greek influence on Roman satire include the mockery of public figures, such as we find in Aristophanes, and more directly, the diatribe. This was a lengthy and often impassioned lecture delivered in a colloquial, hectoring style about the vices and follies of mankind. Lucilius, who was born in 180 BC, was regarded by the Romans as the father of satire, and his style is marked by intemperate attacks on his enemies. In the 30s BC, Horace wrote two books of satires, which he called Conversations, Sermones. And as the title suggests, they're in a colloquial vein, and they're much less vituperative. There are no attacks on living figures, and instead of focusing on public issues, he deals mainly with issues that involve him personally. Where he exposes vice, he does so in a way to encourage its correction. But even though his tone is restrained, Horace conveys considerable unease at the tenor of the age, marred as it is by the effects of prolonged civil wars. In the hands of Juvenal, by contrast, who was writing in the early decades of the 2nd century AD, satire became a devastating condemnation, not only of the viciousness of mankind in general, but also of the age in particular, something which had no Greek precedent. In his 6th satire, he writes, "Now we endure the evils of a long-lasting peace. Luxury, more savage than war, broods over us and exacts vengeance on behalf of a subjugated world." But even this sentiment, original though its tone and emphasis is, would not have quite the force it does were it not for the Greeks, because Juvenal wrote in hexameter verse, and that gives his anger a kind of heroic force. Just listen to those lines in Latin. "Nunc Patimur longai parcis malasaivir armis. Luxuri incubuit, victum quol quiscita urbem. Last, I'm going to turn to the novel. Novels are probably the most popular literary genre today. They certainly weren't in antiquity, and there was nothing remotely equivalent to a bestseller. Caesar's Commentaries on the Gallic War, which uses a very limited vocabulary, some 1,300 words in all, was quite possibly the first work to be written with a mass readership in mind, although we have no means of knowing how it might have circulated. Novels were regarded with some disdain by the literary establishment, belonging, as they did, to a profoundly unserious genre that didn't teach you anything, unlike history, which was full of stirring exemplar that provided role models for the reader to follow. The origins of the novel are buried in the mists of time. In the Greek world, they can be traced at least as far back as the beginnings of literature. In fact, many of the staple features of the novel, including exotic locations, evil villains, separation and reunion with one's loved ones, the twin themes of disguise and recognition, reversals of fortune and a happy ending, all these are already present in the Odyssey, dated around 700 BC. Stories with these novelistic features were circulating in the Mediterranean in the second millennium BC, possibly even earlier, and very likely they passed freely from one culture to another. Strabo, for instance, writing in the late 1st century BC, records a version of the Cinderella story, which he places in a Greco-Roman setting. The novel in the structured form that we recognise today, however, was a relative latecomer to Greek literature, and that is probably one of the main reasons why it had relatively little prestige. No ancient critic had much to say about it. Only five Greek novels survive intact. The most widely read today is Longus's pastoral novel entitled Daphnis and Chloe, thought to belong to the late 2nd or early 3rd century AD, which explores the awakening of sexual desire in two teenagers. It's light-hearted and humorous and imbued with a touch of self-conscious mockery. Only two Roman novels survive, but they are both works of genius, which far outstrip their Greek models in originality, inventiveness, social realism, exuberance, and wit. The earlier of the two is by Petronius. It's called the Satyricon, or to give it its full title, the Libri Satyricon, the Books of Satyric Deeds. Satyrs were mythological creatures invented by the Greeks whose whole existence was directed to the satisfaction of their bodily, principally carnal, desires. The hero, or rather the anti-hero, is a Greek student called Encolpius. Encolpius, in the course of his travels, picks up a handsome slave boy called Giton, with whom he falls in love. And a third youth called Ascyltos tags along, and they become a ménage à trois. The novel, or at least the parts of it that survive, is set in Italy, in the Greek-speaking cities of Puteoli in the Bay of Naples and Croton in the south. Petronius's novel is, however, a thoroughly Roman work. It appropriates many of the conventions that we encounter in the Greek novel and turns them upside down in order to parody them. The bisexual, thoroughly loose-living Encolpius and Giton are the exact antithesis to the completely chaste and exclusively heterosexual lovers that we encounter in Greek novels. And instead of Artemis, goddess of chastity, and Aphrodite, goddess of love, decorously guiding the lovers along the straight and narrow, it is Priapus, god of erections, who calls the shots. The most famous scene in the Satyricon is a dinner party that is hosted by a filthy rich freedman called Trimalchio. Trimalchio is vulgar, flamboyant, boastful, and uneducated. He's a perfect example of a parvenu, and it's clear that he's drawn from real life. He's preoccupied with his back passage, a thoroughly Roman obsession, one might add. When he first enters, he delivers a long speech about the state of his bowels. There's nothing like him in the whole of extant Greek literature, and if you don't have a strong stomach, you'll find him deeply offensive. At the same time, like Shakespeare's Falstaff, he's a life force, and his exuberance is truly infectious. The later novel by Apuleius is the Metamorphoses, more commonly known as The Golden Ass. Apuleius was born around AD 125 in the Roman province of Africa. He was educated in Athens, Rome, and Carthage. The narrator of his novel is a young man named Lucius, who comes from the city of Patras in the Peloponnese. While visiting northern Greece on business, Lucius becomes eager to discover the secrets of witchcraft, for which the region was famous, and in the course of his inquiries, he's turned into an ass. He proceeds to describe the adventures that he undertook in that guise, while all the time seeking to recover his human shape. Apart from containing much that is explicitly erotic, Apuleius' novel is both humorous and serious by turns. Underpinning the novel is the idea that humans aren't much different from animals. The seriousness comes through in the final book, when Lucius is transformed back into a man thanks to the intervention of Isis, a goddess whose cult, as we've seen, was very popular in this era. When he prays to her, Lucius demonstrates not only his consciousness of his own worthlessness, but also his unwavering belief in her saving grace. The Christian parallel is very close. It's the nearest thing to a conversion narrative that the pagan world has left us. It's comparable in a way to the story of St. Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus in Acts, even though, and this is a very important proviso, we can't be absolutely certain that Apuleius isn't pulling our leg and that the ending isn't a huge joke. Whereas the Greek novel tends to place considerable weight upon the sexual fidelity of its principal characters, the Roman novel, as I've indicated, parodies this theme. It also includes much earthy realism, which appeals to Roman taste. At the same time, it's highly likely that there were equally racy Greek novels that haven't survived. One such work, thought to have influenced both Petronius and Apuleius, is the Milesian Tales of Aristides, about 100 BC, which was reputedly translated into Latin soon after its composition. To conclude, as in other branches of the Greco-Roman culture, so in literature, the Romans were never merely imitative. Indeed, if either literature had failed to survive the passage of time, the loss to Western civilization would be incalculable. In the next lecture, we turn to education, in which, as we shall see, literature played a central part.